Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm John Wheeler, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Japan Society and to this very important and timely program on racial tolerance in times of crisis, looking at the Japanese-American and the Arab-American experience here in the United States. With your indulgence, I just want to bring to your attention two series of programs that are coming up that I think are very interesting, some that are related to what we're doing this evening. In January and February, we're going to start a new series called Religion and Politics in Asia. And there will be two programs coming up, one in January and one in February. On Monday, January 28th, we'll have Ian Reeder, Professor of Religious Studies from Lancaster University in England. He'll talk about Japan. And his topic is From Terrorism and Danger to Religious Revival, Religion and Cultural Unease in Japan Today. That's on January 28th, also at 6:30. On Tuesday, February 12th, again at 6:30, we will look at Korea. And we will have Laurel Kendall, a curator of Asian ethnographic collections at the American Museum of Natural History. And her topic will be the cultural politics of shamans in the Republic of Korea. It's on Tuesday, February 12th. The series, again, Religion and Politics in Asia. And in March, as part of our continuing series on the global security issues, we title it Global Security Roundtable, we'll have two very interesting programs. On Monday, March 11th, at 6 o'clock, with a reception beginning at 5 preceding it, we will have four distinguished present and former ambassadors, two Japanese and two American, called Ambassadors Roundtable. We will take a look back at the U.S.-Japan relationship, where we've come in the last 50 years, and where they see it heading in the years to come. We'll have Ryozo Kato, who is the present Japanese ambassador in Washington, fairly recently arrived. Thomas Foley, the immediate past American ambassador to Japan. Walter Mondale, a former U.S. ambassador to Japan, and of course, former vice president of the United States. And Yoshio Okawara, who several years ago was the Japanese ambassador in Washington. It'll be moderated by David Sanger, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. It should be a very interesting evening on Monday, March 11th. And finally, on Tuesday, March 14th, again, as part of our Global Security Roundtable, we'll take a look at rebuilding Afghanistan and what Japan's role has been in that process. As you know, in the last few days, there's been a major meeting in Tokyo on this subject, a major international meeting, and we will have one of the principals from the Japanese side in this whole effort, Sadako Ogata, who many of you know. She is now Japan's special representative for Afghanistan. She was formerly the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. We'll also have Barnett Rubin, Director of Studies and Senior Fellow at the Center on International Cooperation at NYU, one of the leading experts on Afghanistan and these issues. And there will be other panelists as well, and that will be on March 14th at 6:30. We now turn to the topic at hand, racial tolerance in times of crisis. We're very happy to be working tonight with the Japanese American Citizens League, with the Arab American Institute, and with Columbia University. And we're very grateful to Salins, Hirschfeld, we'll get this all right, Heilbrunn, Christie, and Viner, if that's correct, a major law firm, of course, here in the United States and a major supporter of the Japan Society, and they are our corporate sponsor for this evening. And I'm delighted now to call on Catherine Remach, who is an associate in the New York firms here at the New York office and in their employment law group, who will give us a few words of greetings. Catherine.
I'm Catherine Remach. I am an employment lawyer at the international law firm Salins. And Salins has had the privilege of participating in many events over the years here at the Japan Society, although this is my first time to be here, and I'm very pleased to be here. I must first express the regrets of Phil Berkowitz, who has been here a number of times and who some of you may know. He was to be here this evening, but was called away to a meeting in Geneva, and so he sends his regrets that he is unable to be here. I'm honored to be here in his place, and I express the sincere pleasure of the entire Salins firm that we're able to sponsor this event at the Japan Society this evening. Our firm has had the great pleasure of assisting a number of companies, including a number of Japanese companies here in the U.S. and abroad, with issues and claims of discrimination and harassment in the workplace, including national origin discrimination, discrimination based on ethnicity and religion as well. So these are topics that I deal with in my everyday practice in a different way from the way they will be talked about tonight, but they are of great interest to me. And I would just like to make the comment that now, in particular, as the globe is shrinking and more companies are doing business in locales where the culture is completely unfamiliar to them, and in particularly since 9/11, as emotions are running high, it is more and more important that we remain vigilantly open to the perspectives of other cultures so that we can have greater understanding and work together in harmony. I'll conclude my welcoming remarks with a comment from Sakato Ogato, mentioned a moment ago, the former UN Commissioner, High Commissioner for Refugees, who spoke to a business group a couple of years ago about the relationship between humanitarian organizations and businesses. And she said, "Governments are interested in people as citizens. Businesses focus on people as shareholders, customers, or employees. Humanitarian agencies are concerned by the plight of certain categories, victims of war, the poor, refugees. We look at people from different perspectives, but the dynamics of our relationships can boost everybody's ability to deal more effectively with people and to fulfill respective responsibilities." And I think this dynamic is only enhanced by cross-cultural opportunities, by a blend of cultures in the workplace that enrich all of our lives. And I very much look forward to this panel discussion, which will give us some additional perspectives about how we can all grow in those respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine, and thanks again to Solens Hirschfeld for your generous support this evening. It's now my pleasure to introduce our boss for this evening, our moderator, presider, who will also introduce our distinguished panel, Kevin Kennedy, the Principal Officer, the Executive Office of the Secretary General of the United Nations. You have the bios of Mr. Kennedy and the other panelists this evening, so I won't belabor them here, but just a few brief words about him before he comes. He's been a member of the Secretary General's staff since February of 2000. He joined the UN Secretariat in 1977. Has worked in the Department of Public Information, as well as the Department of Humanitarian Affairs, and has served in a variety of posts both here at headquarters in New York and in the field. He's including the UN Observer Mission in South Africa. He's been in Washington. He's been in London. And he's worked on or in some of the most important and difficult missions the UN has been involved with, including places like East Timor, Kosovo, Burundi, Central African Republic, the Western Sahara, Haiti, and many others. Seems like everything the UN has been involved in, he has been there. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Kennedy, Kevin Kennedy of the UN, and his distinguished panel. Kevin, it's all yours.
Good evening, and I apologize for this very FM voice that I don't normally have. I'm a little bit under the weather, so I promise to try and cough away from the microphone. I'd like to start off this evening by thanking John Wheeler and his colleagues at the Japan Society for inviting me to be part of this program tonight. I feel privileged both as a member of the UN Secretariat, but also as a concerned American. And those are hats that sometimes sit uneasily on someone's head, and I hope that this evening you will allow me to step a little bit out of the secretariat mode to take part in this discussion as American concerned about what happens in the United States right now. I think just by way of a very, very brief comment, I was particularly interested in the title of tonight's discussion. There is a meaning in words, and I think it's quite fortuitous that the Japan Society and its sponsors, co-sponsors with tonight's program, have chosen to entitle the session Racial Tolerance in Times of Crisis and not Racial Intolerance in Times of Crisis. And I think that is an important note to strike, particularly as we are talking about the the shared experiences of two communities, obviously the Japanese-American community and the Arab-American community, in two different historical contexts, but which nonetheless have the ultimate goal of achieving tolerance within a larger social context. So I would like to congratulate them on that choice of a title. If I may just say a few very, very brief comments about each of the speakers this evening. You have the bios. But if I can go from my left to the far left, first of all, Albert Mochaber. Mr. Mochaber since first joining the staff of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in 1984 as director of its legal services, he's counseled thousands of members and developed a national legal referral network consisting of hundreds of attorneys. He's represented the ADC before the United States Supreme Court in a landmark decision which held that Arab Americans were entitled to full protection under the Civil Rights Act. He was also instrumental in helping the ADC obtain temporary protected status for foreign nationals in need of safe haven until conditions in their home countries permitted their return. Nationals of Lebanon, Kuwait, El Salvador, Somalia, and the former Yugoslavia have all benefited from this status. He served as national president of the ADC and is currently vice chairman of its board. And he's a partner in the law firm of Mochaber and Moretti, with an international practice dealing with individual and corporate clients in areas of administrative, corporate, international, and immigration law. To his left is Professor Gary Okihiro. Professor Okihiro serves concurrently as director of the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race and director of the Asian American Studies Program at Columbia University. He's written extensively on questions of race and ethnicity in the context of America's history and culture and those of other countries, and his work on the history of the Japanese-American community in the United States is particularly notable. Among his award-winning works are titles such as Storied Lives, Japanese-American Students in World War II, End World War II, Whispered Silences, Japanese-Americans and World War II, Margins and Mainstreams, Asians in American History and Culture, and Cane Fires, the anti-Japanese movement in Hawaii. He's currently working on a new book, Island History, Hawaii and the World. And then to the far left, to my far left, to your far right, let's hope that's not a political designation on either side of the table, is Professor Carol Gluck. Since 1988, she has been the George Sansom Professor of History at Columbia. Dr. Gluck has made many important contributions to the historical understanding of ideology, history, and memory in modern Japan, and has engaged in some of the most significant debates of the late 20th century historiography. She's been an educational innovator in the teaching of history and Asian studies. She's the recipient of many honors and awards and has served as president of the Association for Asian Studies. Her honors and awards include the John King Fairbank Prize of the American Historical Association and the Lionel Trilling Award of Columbia University for her work, Japan's Modern Myths. She's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a recipient of the Mark Van Doren Award and Great Teacher Award for teaching at Columbia. She's just completed a 7-year term as a government-appointed member of the Japan-U.S. Friendship Commission, and among her recent articles are two titles, Doing Justice to the Past and Imagined Histories, American Historians Interpret the Past. Those are the panelists. As usual in my career, I feel like a janitor seated at a table of surgeons. So I will keep my comments very, very brief to open up the discussion tonight. I would like, however, to draw attention to just a couple of aspects of tonight's discussion that I think bear mentioning. Immediately after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11th, the Secretary General of the United Nations made it abundantly clear that the United Nations and the world community felt a strong sense of unity with the people of the United States in rejecting these acts of terrorism, these outrages. And he made the point in his early statements on that matter that this was an attack on all humanity and that all humanity has a stake in defeating the forces behind it. He had an op-ed piece in the New York Times a few days after the attacks, and he made the following point. He said, essential to the global response to terrorism is that it not fracture the unity of September 11th. While the world must recognize that there are enemies common to all societies, it must equally understand that they are never defined by religion or national descent. No people, No region and no religion should be targeted because of the unspeakable acts of individuals. Just a few days ago, the Security Council met to hear the first report of the committee that was charged by the Council with assembling a report on the actions taken by countries to counter terrorism. And in his statement at the Council meeting, the Secretary General made that same point again. He said, "We should all be clear that there is no trade-off between effective action against terrorism and the protection of human rights. On the contrary," he said, "I believe that in the long term, we shall find that human rights, along with democracy and social justice, are one of the best prophylactics against terrorism. While we certainly need vigilance to prevent acts of terrorism and firmness in condemning and punishing them, it will be self-defeating if we sacrifice other key priorities, such as human rights, in the process." So with those as background comments from the Secretary General, which I feel privileged to bring to you this evening, I'd like to open up the program this evening by asking Mr. Mokhiber to introduce the current situation as he sees it, and giving us a bit of the background of the Arab American experience in dealing with what is apparently something that goes very much against the grain of the title of tonight's program, the phenomenon of intolerance. So, Mr. Mokhiber, if you please.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the Japan Society for inviting us. We wish we didn't have to be here, but at the same time, I'm sure most of you, especially those Japanese Americans in the crowd, wish you didn't have to relive this very sad tale that I'm about to tell you, and hopefully we'll have a happy ending. But at this point in history, we're in a very tenuous situation. Let me give you first a little background about the organization that I represent, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. It was formed in 1980 as a result of ABSCAM. I don't know how many of you remember the FBI's attempt to lure less than honorable congresspeople with bribes, but the bribes were being given by FBI agents dressed as Arab sheikhs. None of them, of course, were Arabs. And if you know anything about the Arab American community, you know it's very difficult to get a donation out of them to begin with, let alone an illegal contribution. But as a result of that institutionalized racism, a former senator, James Aberesk from South Dakota, the first Arab American senator, formed the organization. That was about 22 years ago. We thought we were going to work our way out of business within a decade. How foolish were we? There are many Arab Americans in this country. They've been here for over 100 years. Some of them actually came with Columbus. We don't want to brag about that because they were the cartographers. They were supposed to take them to India. Instead, they brought them here. But nonetheless, we're here. And we're here like all of you, like all Americans. For the most part, we're hardworking, family-oriented people who are just trying to make ends meet. I guess I fit the stereotype. I'm short, dark, and good-looking. But other than that, we do have another stereotype of bombers, billionaires, and belly dancers. That's what Professor Jack Shaheen has written about in one of his books on the Arab American. And it's a hard stereotype to break, because once you start to dehumanize an entire people, then you can victimize them, and people don't care. And that's exactly what's happened to the Arabs over the last several decades. They've been reduced to terrorists, collectively. Not that 19 people who bombed the World Trade Center were criminals. They became all Arabs and all Muslims. And if that were the case, I wouldn't be sitting here today. But it's not the case. And it's our job and our organization, hopefully collectively and hand by hand with other Arab or other Americans, especially within the Japanese American community, because you know so much about these issues, we can move forward and make some lemonade out of these lemons. But I'm going to quickly go over some of the facts that have occurred since 9/11, and we'll leave plenty of time, hopefully, for Q&A. Unfortunately, there were a lot of hate crimes. There were over 500 registered hate crimes with our organization, and many of them are being investigated by the Justice Department, and there have been a handful of indictments already. Now, to the credit of the administration and of the state of New York, the mayor, and other political leaders across the country, the good news is there was a very strong voice from the Secretary General's statements to the President of the United States, globally, nationally, internationally, against stereotyping, against making the Arab or Muslim the victim and keeping that particular phase in check.
Unfortunately, on the reverse end of that, Justice Department, came some very draconian measures in the form of the USA Patriot Act, which I'll talk about a little bit more shortly. So you have great statements saying don't go after these good Americans, these Arabs and Muslims, coming from political leaders, which hopefully kept some of these hate crimes down, and we see that they are receding. But still, over 500 that were registered, from simple harassment to employment discrimination to actual acts of murder. Sadly, many of those who were attacked were not even Arab or Arab Americans or Muslims. Many of them were Sikhs, fellows who were wearing turbans and beards but were mistaken and were attacked. And I'm told that there was even a rabbi here in New York who was mistaken for an Arab and was beaten. So it just shows you how ridiculous it is to stereotype people and to go after them for those reasons. There has been a great problem with airlines. Many Arab Americans have been forced off of airlines. People just like myself sitting on an airline looking the way we do. And you know, especially the Japanese American, we may be here for four or five generations. We still have looks of Arab Americans or Japanese Americans. And people stereotype on our looks alone that, this must be the bad guy who's coming from overseas. One of the victims on September 11th was himself, a Lebanese, going to Canada, or to California to be married. He was hijacked and crashed into World Trade Center. His name didn't even appear on a list of the dead because somebody must have thought he was a bad guy, right? The most, I think, striking example was a Secret Service agent who was not even allowed to go on the plane Christmas Day. He was a personal agent attached to President Bush going to Texas, and he was taken off. That's how high up the chain this type of discrimination and racism can go. The schools have all faced it. Students have had problems. You know what I'm talking about. It's out there, unfortunately. The civil liberty concerns that we have are twofold. One, from the legislation that's been enacted. The other are from acts, presidential acts, executive orders, and so on, that have diminished the rights, not just of Arabs in this country, but of all people who are here. Now, there's two categories, those who are citizens who have still a higher degree of support and those who are non-citizens. The non-citizens can include green card holders who have been here 10, 20, 30, 40 years, doesn't matter. They all fall within the same category. And as a result, the very, very drastic measures that were taken allow for sweeping new powers to detain non-citizens indefinitely, indefinite detention in the United States, okay? Reduced standards of cause and levels of judicial review for searches and seizures. It is now what they call a peek and sneak. They can come into an apartment or an office building when you're not there, do a search, and leave and not tell you, maybe for a week or a month later. Right? And then the whole issue of guilt by association. You may be found to be deportable or to have violated a law of the United States by just associating with somebody who may have views or may have done something that you didn't even know about. Even if you contributed money to an organization that has a tax-exempt status in the United States, and it can go retroactively back in time. This is just the headlines. I'll get into more of these in the question and answer, but these are some of the more very scary parts of the Patriot Act. The military tribunals, the eavesdrops on attorney-client privileges, the interview of 5,000 Arab men, the increased scrutiny of visa applications, just go on and on and on. Now, before I end, let me tell you that during the Gulf War, there was a similar backlash against the Arab community, as you can imagine. And at that time, I was called to a member of Congress who sat me down and said, listen, young man, I'm going to tell you something that you better learn. Your community needs to be very, very aware of the Japanese-American experience. Now, the congressman was Norm Mineta, who most of you, I'm sure, know very well. Congressman Mineta went out of his way to sit me down and to give me a firsthand account of the experience he faced as an American citizen in the detention camps during World War II and said, if you're not careful, the same thing will happen to your community. And sure enough, not too long afterwards, we received an anonymous package from somebody from the Justice Department with what was called the INS Contingency Plan. In that plan was a program to round up Arabs in the United States and put them in detention centers in Oakdale, Louisiana. All right? We confronted the government with it. We went up to the presidency. We went down to the media level. We went all over, raised the issue. We finally got an assurance from the government that it would not take place, that it was a low-level policy plan, never would ever see the light of day. But the fact is, somebody at the Justice Department was concerned enough to leak it to us. Right? It could have happened. And what scares Arab Americans the most today is when I tell them that the Japanese internment camps did not take place until 18 months after Pearl Harbor. So even though things have calmed down for the Arab Americans now, it could always happen. I don't think it will because of the horrible situation of the Japanese Americans, and I think because of the vigilance of coalition work of many Americans today. But we are now in a self-imposed type of internment camp because of the chilling effect that the legislation has had and that the hate crimes have had on the community. As such, we need your support as Japanese Americans, as all Americans, to build coalitions, to one, educate our fellow Americans, two, to act in coalition to stop this type of thing and reverse these types of draconian measures, thirdly, to become vigilant, and fourth, to be united at all levels so that all Americans will be safeguarded. We are the weakest link, no doubt, in this chain of civil rights today, but the legislation doesn't say anything specific about Arabs or Muslims. Anybody could be affected by this legislation. So with that, we hope we can take the crisis and bring something good about not repeating the history of the Japanese-American experience and saying farewell to all internment camps for all people. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'd like now to turn to Professor Okihiro, and perhaps he can help us put this into a bit of historical context in terms of the Japanese-American community's experience.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. And I'm afraid I'm going to reiterate some of the things that Albert has said because he said it so well. It's a commonplace idea that during times of national crisis or during times of war, all Americans are drawn together. United we stand is the ubiquitous motto, if not mandate. While true for some, the truth is that during war and national crises, just the opposite of unity might also happen. That is, intolerance might increase because unanimity is oftentimes required. Definitions of loyalty, patriotism, narrows and becomes a prescription. Designations of community members become sharper, the distinction between us and them. And pre-existing social cleavages are oftentimes exacerbated. Thus, in the days following 9/11, the nation rallied around the victims and the flag, but also for those deemed not us, other things happened, as Albert also mentioned. Thousands of reports of racial harassment, intimidation, including threatening gestures, speech, shootings, vandalizing of homes, businesses, and mosques. A Hindu temple was burned to the ground in Canada. A white man drove a car into a mosque in Ohio. Whites attacked an Asian Indian and his white friend in San Francisco. Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh, was killed in Mesa, Arizona, in what is now clearly a hate crime. Vakar Hassan, a Pakistani, was killed in Dallas. Dozens of Arabs, Central, West, South Asians were removed from flights and harassed. Dozens of those groups of people, again, students, left colleges and universities throughout America. Hundreds of suspects were summarily questioned, arrested, detained, even as we speak. 9/11 has been likened to Pearl Harbor in that the attack was sudden, allegedly unprovoked, waged by fanatics against innocents, unsuspecting. To some commentators, it was a clash of civilizations. And America lost its innocence in the attacks. While the nation slumbered, its enemies worked their enmity, their hatreds. And like the days following Pearl Harbor, there were prominent calls for tolerance. Yes, after Pearl Harbor, there were prominent calls for tolerance. And at the same time, there were calls for retaliation, acts of intolerance, harassment, murders, beatings, and vandalizing. All of that is very familiar. a fear of immigrants, especially immigrants of color, from the enemy's place of origin. Both legal and illegal immigrants were questioned, viewed with suspicion, because these threatened the nation's unity, its security. In fact, they were even more dangerous because they lurk among us, a shadowy presence, invisible yet palpable, a specter. The enemy is everywhere but nowhere. He could be your friend, your neighbor. In fact, according to some high government officials even, these take advantage of U.S. democracy, the open society. They abuse, mock our open way of life. And hence, they are even more insidious. And because of this uncommon enemy, this uncommon war, we have to take special measures, the homeland defense. There is a greater tolerance for intolerance, a curtailment of civil liberties for safety. It's an exchange. Increased surveillance and racial profiling. For example, the story is familiar historically about World War II when right after, a few hours after, in fact, while the smoke was still rising from the ships in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii declared martial law, under which rights of habeas corpus and so forth were suspended, one's civil liberties were, and military rule prevailed in the islands, which was a U.S. territory. The West Coast instituted military controls over which places were prohibited. Persons were prohibited from entering certain places, and curfews were instituted. By executive order, and again, this is key, that is, the executive acts frequently on behalf of the nation because of their responsibility for the nation's security and for carrying out the war. 9066 was in February of 1942. And in the summer of that year, mass exclusion and detention of all of the West Coast Japanese Americans were instituted. And of course, we oftentimes forget, towards the end of the war, the government enabled a renunciation program for Japanese Americans to renounce their citizenship, and after the war, to repatriate those deemed disloyal or unpatriotic or non-American during the war. And those are familiar, which Albert also mentioned today, that is, freedom of speech is restricted, unanimity is required, no aid to enemy, the media itself imposes self-censorship, professors who are critical of the war effort are deemed unpatriotic, immigration controls are instituted with anticipated deportation, suspects rounded up, interrogated, detained, military tribunals enabled by, again, executive fiat, because, as the Attorney General said, terrorists don't deserve the protection of the Constitution. And on the part of the affected peoples, both Japanese Americans and those generalized brown people who are deemed to be the enemy, oftentimes mistaken identities, fly the flag, and they display the Christian cross for protection. I ride the taxis here very often, and you'll notice that brown taxi drivers in particular display prominently the flag, and I notice the U.S. flag, and I notice also people displaying their country of origin flags, like Pakistan or India. Is sort of like saying that I'm Indian, not Afghan, so I'm okay, sort of like what Chinese wore during World War II, Chinese please, not Japanese, for their own protection. The calls to assimilate, to change their dress, to not speak their language, to be aware of gatherings, to contribute to the war effort or to the disaster, the murders, in terms of blood, to contribute money, all of these are parallels. And yet there are also differences. We live in very different historical moments, and there are different politics at play. So because of that history, Arab Americans, Southwest Central Asians can refer to the Japanese American internment. never again might be the call. In fact, one of the rallies for civil liberties after 9/11 was held at the Washington, D.C. Memorial to Japanese-American soldiers. And the point was very strongly made because of the redress reparations movement by Japanese-Americans. Also, Arab-Americans, Sikhs, South Asians, Central Asians were exhorted by various community organizations to exert their civil liberties, to report hate crimes, to write to Congress. In fact, one of the Sikh Media Watch that I look at frequently advised various Department of Transportation and so forth on sensitivity and so forth. But all of that was made possible because of past civil rights struggles and the gains of African Americans, women, Japanese Americans, but also perhaps made possible by present-day geopolitics, the economics, the need for the Arab world by the United States, and perhaps oil. But the lessons of the past for me are also encouraging. They're not entirely discouraging, because they indicate that past struggles for freedom have present consequences. We stand on the shoulders of those who went before. We thus must know our history. And that the victims and resistors of intolerance ensure and protect the rights, as Albert said, and civil liberties of all Americans, not just of those people. Because by preserving the protections, the guarantees of the Constitution, our civil liberties and our human rights, they ensure that for all Americans. Thank you.
I agree with everything you said, so I don't have too much more to say. The one thing I'd like to say, in addition to agreeing with what Professor Okihiro said, as a historian, is that one of the things that is worrisome is the way we use the lessons of the past. I, for one, was very disturbed in the immediate hours after the terrorist attacks when the Pearl Harbor analogy was all over the airwaves, I mean, within 45 minutes. And it was all over the airwaves with, in the mouths of teenagers, of movie stars, of Henry Kissinger. I mean, it was not orchestrated. It was this sort of spontaneous reaction. I was disturbed because it's a terrible analogy. And when Japanese press in Japan, when the opinion said, well, what is this? Is this something about Japanese? And I very shortly after Pearl Harbor, wrote a column for Newsweek Japan, said, don't worry, it's not about you. It's all about us. Pearl Harbor was really used as an analogy, not for what had happened, but for the American response to attack. So that it had the right, if you like, national spirited call, but it was the wrong use of the past because there was really nothing, very little about the terrorist attacks of 9/11 that were like Pearl Harbor. And so that started me as a historian kind of campaign of my own to try to keep the past where it belongs. You know, I mean, it's not, as a historian, it's not that I don't think we should learn from the past. That would be silly for me to say that, and Gary and I agree on that. But it's too easy to learn the wrong lessons. So I want to be sure that when we look at the experience of Japanese Americans during the Second World War, we don't overleap and see too many parallels, which might mislead us now. They might mislead us about the past, but worse, they could mislead us about how we should be behaving now. Gary said it very well. Things are not the same now. We live in a different historical moment. On the other hand, people are always capable of hate and hostility, and it's always ready to erupt. I mean, there's no question about that. After 9/11, the fact that so many people, not as many people as evoked Pearl Harbor, but the fact that so many people mentioned the experience of the Japanese Americans in World War II, showed you that something had changed. If this attack had happened 25 years ago, they would not have been mentioned except by members of the Japanese American community and other people who knew about that past. Now, that's important because it shows a change. It builds on, as you say, civil rights achievements over the last half century. But when you think of how hard it was for Japanese Americans to get that point made, the long redress movement, and then the final compensation, you realize that, I mean, it didn't happen really in this sort of public sense until the really late 80s, early 90s that people knew about internment. So in one sense then, it is something that people understand. We must never do that again. The problem is that's probably not what's going to happen. Despite the Gulf War internment plan, I don't think that would have happened in 91 either. Mark Twain is alleged to have said, but probably didn't, that history does not repeat itself. At best, it sometimes rhymes. And the problem with this, it's been 60 years since 1942, 60 years since internment. That's a full zodiacal cycle in the Asian calendar. This doesn't suggest that we're back where we started. So even if history is going to rhyme, it's not likely going to rhyme in the same way. So we need to draw the lessons, I think, from the Japanese-American experience in just the terms that you've heard it spoken here, not so specifically in terms of internment or detention, because that's probably not what's going to happen, and not specifically in terms of the specificities, the concreteness of each of the groups. The situations were very different. Don't let anybody tell you that the so-called war on terror is the same kind of situation as the Second World War. And anybody who tells you that, including the Justice Department, needs to be put back in its place for doing bad history. So it's important, I think, for us to try to draw on the lessons, but then to realize that we are in a time that we have to deal with in our own way. And from that point of view, I think that what Albert said and what Gary said, we all feel the same way. We have to do it together. And here I'll give you another historian's view of the last 50 years. One advantage the United States has is that the United States at least has the ideal of being a multi-ethnic country. I mean, at least, and a lot of countries don't. Japan is one of them. So at least the United States has this ideal of multi-ethnic melting pot. It used to be. Now it's a salad bowl. The ideal, of course, has been violated more than it's been upheld, one can say. But it is important for us to remember that there is something we need to keep articulating that we need to live up to. And when the USA Patriots Act violates our basic civil liberties, we have to say that this is violating basic civil liberties is something that Americans will not stand for, and that people with green cards have rights and things of that sort. We have to remember that. We have to remember it together is my point, and not simply as the particularly affected group, because that's divisive. And in some way, the last 50 years since the Second World War, there's been real progress in the development, I think, of people's, well, it's the melting pot to the salad bowl. The melting pot was not a melting pot. It was a smelting pot. Everybody had to be, quote unquote, in the 1920s, 100% American. You came here, and unless you got as American as you could be, which meant no national dress, and it meant no language, and it meant often, in some cases, sort of low-key religion, you were not considered part of the United States, 100% American. And that's the background for the exclusion, the Immigration Exclusion Act of 1924, and it's also the background for the internment in 1942. I mean, in fact, there's a historical link there. and the reason that the Germans were not interned, et cetera, and so forth. So one can see in the decades since the Second World War that the metaphor, when it moves to salad bowl, that's good because everybody doesn't have to be the same. And the problem, of course, is that in getting there, we have divided ourselves into our different ethnicities. We have located ourselves in our hyphenates. We have our activism is very, very much identity-based. And that's been good, because without the ADC, they probably would, the FBI would probably still be dressing up like sheikhs in their scam operations. This activism is really another part of the United States, is that each of these affected groups is extremely activist, and they've made tremendous progress, and not least the African Americans, and that's why you do have a legacy of civil rights. But what do you do in a salad bowl when you've got every bit of lettuce, tomato, and carrot insisting on its own color and taste with good reason, and not being able necessarily to think of the whole? That worries me. Now, here's a lesson of the past that says we do need to act together. And that this, if we don't act together on behalf of all hyphenates, all something Americans, you know, because we all are hyphenates, then I think we'll be learning, if you like, the wrong lesson of this particular past. So it's very good for Japanese Americans and Arab Americans and all sorts of Americans to work together. These are all our civil liberties, and these are all of our civil rights. And the chill effect that Albert spoke about is actually a kind of civil violence. It's a kind of violence of civil rights if people cannot wear their national costume, if they can't speak up. I mean, when unity becomes unanimity in Gary's sense. And the only way to deal with that, it seems to me, the only way to have what we call democracy, democratic politics, is to carve out some kind of common ground, because you can't have democratic politics without something in common. And in this case, the commonality has to do with fighting on behalf of all of our civil rights, has been said, against this kind of ethnic profiling. It's going to be a very long, hard row. It's going to be harder than the road the Japanese Americans had to, believe it or not, because the times are different, because this is a different situation, and because there are these forces revving up the country on behalf of patriotism, which themselves really have to be called into question, it seems to me. We simply can't contest that we're more patriotic than, we're as patriotic as the rest. That's the old loyalty question. We have to question what patriotism means in the United States. Patriotism in the United States means protecting our civil liberties, protecting our common ideals. So as a historian, I want very much to very selectively and very carefully make connections to the past and realize that our biggest challenge right now lies in the fact that the future is not going to look like the past. And it's likely to be harder even than it was in the years following the Japanese-American internment. Thank you.
Thank all of you for those initial comments. I think we'd like to go to questions and answers and get as much interaction going between the panel and all of you as possible. I would only ask that when you pose your questions, you identify yourselves, try to keep your questions brief and direct, and either direct them to a member of the panel or to everyone as you wish. I would like to lead off with one question, and forgive me for injecting a personal note into this. I listened very carefully to these comments, and what strikes me about all of the panelists is that each of them is in his or her own way, passionate about education, whether it's advocacy or whether it is the teaching of history or the teaching of regional studies. What I've noticed in my own children, I have children who are middle school age, roughly, they have studied the Japanese internment in the Japanese American internment in 1942. And what I find a very curious phenomenon that I would like to ask the panel to react to. What I find is that my kids acknowledge that what happened to Japanese Americans in 1942 was wrong. They fully recognize the injustice that represented. But I find that when I probe and when we talk about the current situation and the current action on the part of American authorities to deal with an as yet unidentified threat, they are much more ambivalent. They are much more equivocal about the degree of injustice that may be done to people who are Arab American or who are simply hyphenated. So I would like to ask the panel to react to that, if they wouldn't mind, because maybe they can give me some guidance on how to deal with my kids in the context. But it really troubles me because there is this moral ambivalence on their part. They can't seem to see that lesson of 1942 through their 2002 eyes. So if I can open up that way and then invite all of you to please signal to me when you'd like to ask a question, and I'll try to do the rounds. So if anyone would like to help me out here.
Well, it seems to me that history is safe insofar as it seems distant. It's not imminent. You know, we can talk about it as it already has happened, and the deed was done, and now we can sort of absolve ourselves of some error or guilt or whatever might arise from that. But the present is quite imminent. It seems very real. It should feel real. Mm-hmm. And that I think the fears, the anxieties, are engendered very clearly, distinctive, within our minds. And I think that I was talking to a colleague of mine, a historian also, very learned man, a huge civil libertarian, wrote a lot on the U.S. Supreme Court and so forth, knows the laws very well. And he admitted to me that he was so scared in the wake of 9/11 that he was willing to trade some of his civil liberties for security. And that instilled in my mind, again, I think people who are distant, that is, that they are not the objects, the direct objects of persecution, of repression, of exclusion. They're a little distant, and so they can figure they can trade some security, rights for security. But those who are affected directly, whose rights are infringed upon, are frequently the ones who are most acute about the experience and about the error of the way, even though they might be silenced because of this pressure for unanimity or certain definitions of patriotism or so forth. And I saw that among the Japanese American population in the past, and among not just Arabs, because Arabs weren't the only ones victimized, or Muslims, but all South, Central, West Asians, this sense of silencing. So, but there were also acts of great courage, not only on the parts of those minority populations, but also on the part of the majority group, both in World War II and presently. I'm talking about white people and African Americans and others who stood up against those kinds of acts of repression. But in any case, I think what happens in the present is that those who are most affected by those draconian measures are frequently the ones who act. And they are the ones who, in my opinion, preserves the rights of my dear friend and colleague, right, who was willing to trade some of his civil liberties for a sense of security.
In fact, what he's saying is, I'm willing to trade mine, but his aren't the ones that are being traded. He's essentially trading somebody else's. My answer to you, Kevin, and it's an answer that we all, to me, it's not just children, it's all of us. And this may sound extremely preacherly, but the fact of the matter is, if you look back, as I do all the time for a living, over the history of the 20th century, one of the things that is most disturbing is how certain things could happen and how populations, how different peoples could let those things happen. This is the one of the biggest questions of the 20th century. The biggest questions of the 20th century are not how did Hitler happen. The biggest question of the 20th century is how did ordinary Germans let that happen, all right? So one thing we've learned from 20th century history is that we all have a responsibility now in our societies that perhaps 200 years ago we didn't have, or 300 years ago if we lived in kingdoms or whatever, and that we can never think ourselves distant from these things. So the question that if you feel that we must be sure these things don't happen again, how do they not happen again? We are the ones who have to prevent it from happening again. I mean, I give you the 95% support rate of the president. Until that falls, we are part of the problem, not the solution, if you have any objections to the things that are happening. So we have, in this country, support rates matter, polls matter, but basically that if you feel you do have responsibility, then you have to ask the children and yourselves and everyone else, what do you think is right now? Not what scares you. You know, what are you afraid of? But what do you think is right? This is a moral question, and that's why you say moral. Do you think it? You don't think it was right to do this then? Do you think A, B, C, D is right? Now, you don't have to have a pre-answering an unasked question. I'm not saying there's an answer to it, but that's the question you have to ask. What do you think is right as an American? You know a lot about civil rights. All middle school children do. What kinds of, and actually work through that. That's what we're not doing. And that's what I know as a historian, people didn't do. All good people didn't do this in lots of places around the world. And when you look back, you can understand why they didn't. It's the same reason why this man said, I'm willing to trade my civil liberties. It's also the reason why people fell silent so often. They were protecting their families. They were fearful. Now, I'm not saying everyone has to go to martyrdom, but the question is, what is right? And unfortunately, these are old-fashioned questions. That's why I say I sound like a preacher. But they're old-fashioned questions. And if you're going to take responsibility for history, if you like, you have to take responsibility in a moral way. It's not a question of a kind of balance sheet about trading in your civil liberties. That's how I would answer it. I mean, that's how I feel you have to. I mean, I talk the same way to our students and to myself all the time.
Benjamin Franklin answered your colleague 150 years ago when he said, he who is willing to trade his civil liberties for security deserves neither. It's in times of crisis that you need those civil liberties. It's in times of crisis that you need the protections of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You don't need them when everything's fine. When you're not threatened, that's when you need them. To your children, I would advise you to bring them and let them play with my kids. They will they will meet real true terrorists. Those are the only Arab terrorists I know are my kids. And that's what it's all about. I mean, this whole, whether it's a melting pot or a smelting pot or a salad bowl or a tabbouleh, because my friend here, Dr. Roshani, makes the best tabbouleh, and everybody can be together and taste distinct but still be one. Or maybe it's sushi, where we're all bound together very deliciously, you see? But those are metaphors, and I don't know that they're all apropos. But, you know, the difference is, in the past, history is ancient, and it is somewhat remote, and the media and the politics are current. And we do need to know what's going on in the past, or we're going to be, as the old Asian saying says, we're going to be duty-bound to fail if we don't learn from the past. The root causes of all these issues we have not talked about, and that's another issue that maybe we can get into.
Thank you. We have a question from the lady here.
My name is Dan.
If you can use the microphone and tell us who you are.
My name is Pam. I'm here as a supporter of the Partisan Defense Committee and the Spartacist League. I want to say there is something we can do to act. I'm bringing to your attention, and for comment as well, an event that is happening on the West Coast just on this very question. on how to mobilize all of us, all the intended victims, and I'm saying now, workers, immigrants, black people, everyone are in this together because the anti-terror moves that have been made, the USA Patriot Act, the Maritime Security Act, all of the anti-immigrant laws are affecting all of us. And on the West Coast, on February 9 at 2 p.m., and we would very much like support here from anyone in the audience who can be yes, there or
Pam,
communicate their
excuse me,
support.
If you have a question for the panel, I mean, I would really ask all of you not to.
No,
we can have paid advertisements afterwards.
But if we can have a question. I want to say that don't you think, panelists, that mobilizing labor in all of its components is really key at this point as they are targeted as airport workers, as baggage handlers, as transport workers in all of the ports, mobilizing all Americans
okay.
who are
I
workers.
Okay, I think there's our question. Our question is the question of mobilizing.
I have materials on this.
If the panelists would like to react to Pam's statement.
There's no question. Education and mobilization go hand in hand. They're necessary. And if you took all the immigrant workers out of this country, I think the country would skid to a halt tomorrow.
All right, there you go. Okay, and we have a lady down here in the center who had a question. Ma'am, if you could wait for the microphone, please.
My name is Jean Ishikawa. I know Mr. Okihiro well. I'm going to go back to the question of the Japanese Americans in the internment issue. That I get the feeling that people think that that has been resolved, and it has not been resolved. Senator Inouye's comment on the Arab American experience was that we had it much more severe, but you know, Senator Inouye is from Hawaii, and he's of course for the vets, and he said we are our military status was taken away. We were all the American vets were demoted to 4Fs, and then interned in the mainland. And I said that is not as much as that is important. It is not the crux issue of the Japanese-American internment issue, is that it is a violation, the grossest violation of the U.S. Constitution, and that our citizenship was negated. And that has not yet been addressed, and the role of the Supreme Court is what needs to be looked at, and we need to reclaim our citizenship as U.S. citizens, which has not been done.
Thank you very much. I think it's a very pertinent comment. If I can add to that just very briefly, the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights spoke at Harvard last autumn, and she made a point that's very much along those lines, saying that when she was at Harvard, she's a Harvard alumnus, I learned of America's experience of constitutionalism, its belief in the rule of law, in democracy and in rights and freedoms, and how these values have shaped the identity of the United States as a country and as a people. I think Ms. Ishikawa's comment goes directly to that, and perhaps, Albert, you would have a little bit more to say on that, given the legislation that you have seen in the pipeline and perhaps some of the failed legislation since the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right. It's not that what's in the pipeline. It's what's come out of the pipeline, and it's sludge. I mean, it's very toxic. I would commend all of you to go to the ACLU website, acl.org. They have a very good analysis of the USA Patriot Act, and section by section. You will be alarmed to see what goes on there. People can now have their medical records, their psychiatric records, their financial records, their school records, all turned over by less than normal due process which was what we would expect in the past. The surges and seizures, the sneak and peek issues, the indefinite detentions. Yes, they're not U.S. citizens, as in the case of the Japanese Americans. And I hope Professor Gluck is right, that, and I agree with her, that I don't think that will ever happen again. But all of those who are not citizens can be held indefinitely here without any hope of getting out, because there aren't those due process rights. The only hope that there is that once there was an ACLU, then it was a Japanese American Citizens League, then it was an ADC and the Japan Society. So as these organizations continue to grow and mount and work in unison and coalesce, hopefully we can work this out together, because we should not be hijacked ourselves in a time of crisis. That Constitution and Bill of Rights is just too important, as your prime example. I would like to ask a question of the audience. How many of you here were either interned yourself or are relatives of people who were? I would be interested in knowing how many were. That's a huge number. Would you tell us what we need to do? Because you were there. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to give us some advice?
The danger of it being a humanitarian issue for the UN, or the danger of making it a moral issue, or which is what the Taliban is doing, or the Ku Klux Klan carrying the cross, becomes very dangerous, I think. And my point is, for the children in this country, is to learn the Constitution. And the Constitution, which is overlooked, you can call it civil libertarian, like you call tolerance or intolerance, but the Constitution is what says that fundamentally, that all creed, regardless of creed, meaning all religion, is have the right to the pursuit of happiness, whether it is color, basic. The fundamental law of this country, U.S., United States, which is the only country in the world that has this democracy as a law coming from the people. And it is the test of the people whether they believe in democracy. If the children, if they believe in the Constitution, that is what has to be in the elementary school.
Thank you. I think Carol, you were making some sounds over there. We'd like to add to that.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. But I think the Constitution stands for something. To my mind, you have to be careful with the Constitution, because people can use the Constitution in a very narrow way. So, to me, the Constitution is part of a larger package. And when I say what do I think is right, I mean part of the larger package of these American ideals to which we must live up and all always fall from. So I think I like civil rights and the Constitution together, because we've had to do a lot of work over 200 years to make the Constitution a better basis. So yes, the Constitution, but also constitutional and civil rights in more broadly spoken.
Thank you. I think we'd like to keep the discussion as broad as possible and to touch on as many aspects of this phenomena of intolerance, or, if you like, subversion of the Constitution, and not become too mired in any one place. There was a gentleman here with a question, and then...
my name is Larry Parks. I'd like to ask a question also having to do with the Constitution, but focusing on what Professor Gluck is talking about. And I wonder if the panel, particularly the professors, would comment on the lack of scholarship in connection with how the Constitution has been, in effect, set aside. Specifically, in 1933, when President Roosevelt was inaugurated, in his inauguration speech, he says to the people and to the Congress that if they don't give him the powers that he feels he needs to address the Depression, he will take the powers he thinks he needs as if we were at war. And as a result of that, we have this doctrine of so-called emergency powers. And at that time, they amended an obscure law called the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917 to give him these extraordinary powers. The question, and the reason this is relevant today, is that these emergency powers are still in effect.
That's right.
Even though there was some effort to get rid of them, I think, in the 1980s. And these emergency powers allow the government, through executive order, to set aside all these civil liberties. And in effect, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has on the books right now, ready to be activated, laws which allow the president to intern whoever he wishes, to seize the transportation network, to seize fuel, to seize the media. So how come, when you want to focus on the civil liberties things, professors such as yourself and other researchers, I don't mean to put you on the spot, how come there isn't more legal research, more effort being devoted to these so-called emergency powers?
Thank you. I love it when people ask questions of a panel and say, I don't want to put you on a spot, as they sit there in the glare of the lights.
Well, you know, I don't know anything about this, but I would bet you, Mr. Parks, that there is a load of legal scholarship on this, and that the real problem is why aren't legal scholars speaking to the broader public so that the people in the broader public know what you know? I don't think it's a question of scholarship. I think it's a question of having scholarship walled off in the so-called ivory tower, and people not who know enough about these things not speaking on the basis of what they know to explain to us what's actually happening in the present, particularly what you said about once we get these laws on the books, they have to be rolled back one by one by one, and you know, and takes time, and they don't ever all get rolled back. I mean, I think it's more the scholars need to be chastised, and I agree with you for not getting what they know out there. So there's the education part of that, but the work mountains. I can't cite it, but I'm that's what I say. I don't know anything about it, but my guess is that the problem is the disconnect between what's there and getting into where we can find it. Unless you are a legal scholar yourself and you know do all that, that's my guess based on other things I know like that. But you know, you could be right. There could be no paper on the emergency powers. I would be very surprised.
Okay, we have questions from several people in the audience, from the lady back here.
Hi, my name is Christine Minami, and I work for the Japanese American Citizens League. I am actually the Washington person who works a lot with the Sikh Media Watch and the ADC, the AI, et cetera, and was one of the organizers of the rally to which you referred earlier at the National Japanese American Memorial to Patriotism. And my observation, and we've been following this a lot, it's very important to us clearly as a community, as well as people interested in civil rights. And I've been struck by something, the danger that I saw personally, and I wanted to get the comments back from the panelists, was in 1942, it took 2 months for one person to institute Executive Order 9066, which allowed for the exclusion of enemy aliens. It didn't specify by race. And Germans and Italian immigrants were also interned under that, in addition to the Japanese-American community. In 2001, it took 1 month for the entire Congress to pass the U.S. Patriot Act, which allows for essentially the same legal thing, the same legal acts. That is, there is very strong parallels between after Pearl Harbor, first-generation Japanese immigrants were rounded up by the FBI, taken off, and their family didn't hear from them 3 months. We're hearing that also from the Arab American communities as well as other people of color. And it seems to me that this is, while I don't think internment will happen again, it seems to me that there's a strong division between us and them. Either you're with us, as President Bush says, or you're with them. And that's defined along lines of nationality and citizenship. It may be to some degree color, but it's very starkly and legally defined in that respect. And I wanted to hear back from the panelists how you thought we can get past that in terms of this perception of anybody who does not hold, you know, an American passport as being outside of the flag of patriotism. We wrap it around us tightly, but we exclude certain people. And they may have been here for 15, you know, generations, but if they look different or if they speak with an accent, it doesn't matter. your comments,
as Albert Mochheimer said earlier, I think the problem that you're referring to actually applies also to people who do hold a U.S. passport or do hold a U.S. identity document. If the panelists have some comments.
Well, let me step out because, you know, Albert can also shoot me down. But, you know, I mean, we mustn't elide the fact that during World War II, Japanese Americans also were victimized, right? Which is obvious, right? We know that. So, like, citizenship did not protect them because of those emergency detention powers under which both could be quickly disposed with. My understanding is since the 19th century, the U.S. Supreme Court has made no distinction between citizen and non-citizen on the basis of the Constitution. The Constitution does not say that all citizens will have these rights. It says all persons. And the Supreme Court has consistently ruled that ostensibly the Constitution protects non-citizen as well as citizen. Of course, that might change with the present court and so forth. But I think citizenship is important, but it also, that is, the Constitution also protects non-citizens. But citizens and non-citizens could be have their rights diminished very quickly. So.
Allow me to shoot.
Yeah.
The case of ADC versus Reno clearly made that distinction, unfortunately. I agree with Gary and that I think that's what the Constitution says, and I think most Americans think that's what the Constitution says, but a very conservative court, by a 5-4 decision, ruled that that would not be the case, that the non-citizens would not enjoy the same due process rights, unfortunately. We're waiting for an opportunity to bring that back up. Unfortunately, I think this era will probably give us more than one opportunity to do so. With respect to, you know, whether or not why it took only a month for the Congress to do it, I think because most people were paralyzed. The Arab American community had self-censored itself out of fear and a false sense of guilt for what had happened. Nobody in the Arab American community had anything to do with that tragedy, and everybody was opposed to it and had a hand in helping victims or were themselves victims, maybe twice over. But the Congress had no excuse. I think the fact that they call it the USA Patriot Act left them with the dilemma. I'm either with or against. And that's a false dichotomy. That's not the case. And that's where we have to start saying no. That's not you're either with the Constitution or you're not with the Constitution. You're either with the Bill of Rights or you're not with the Bill of Rights. You're either with the full body and history of the United States or you're not. That's really where it should be framed. Like one person said, we shouldn't be wrapping ourselves in a flag, but in the Constitution. We shouldn't be burning the flag. Maybe we should be washing it. Those are the types of analogies that we have to put out there. Spin doctors are out there. Problem is we don't control the airways. With the exception of news agencies like Pacifica, most mainstream media was, as the professor said, within 45 minutes, already forming opinions which set the whole mainstream thinking. And that includes for the Arab Americans themselves. We read the same media. We watch the same media. We read the same textbooks as everyone else. And that sets our minds. So we need people to speak out. You folks are the hope.
Was ADL Reno Supreme Court or District Court?
Supreme Court, yeah.
Okay.
When we talk to
I think we have time for just a couple more questions. There's one lady down here who had asked for the microphone. Very good. And then there was one here. Yes? Was if you could wait for the microphone, please.
My family is Italian-American, and we actually came across one of these internment cards from my grandmother, and we never knew what it was, but it basically said that if she was called upon, she had to report to the authorities or she could be arrested, and we never knew anything about this. Could you maybe talk a little bit about anything that you might know about this?
Well, Italian-Americans were interned. I mean, you probably know more about this than I do, but there was not in as great numbers, obviously, as the Japanese-American. I mean, it's a different dimension, but they were interned, right?
Yeah, but they were also wrongly suspected. I mean, they were investigated by the FBI, and they were presumably both Germans and Italians who had links to fascist organizations. Now, obviously, they were incorrect in many cases. So your grandmother was no doubt exempt from that. But there were, and there are several books on the subject, and I'll be happy to tell you about them if you want.
Go ahead. I just wanted to ask something about the last question, but go ahead. Wait.
Yeah, I think you had a question up there on the aisle and had one here. Yeah.
My name is Diane Shihab, a third-generation Arab-American on one side, and on the other side, lived in Beirut for 8 years, where I got to know about the Middle East issues, and then later in studying in Paris. The question I asked of everybody, but especially of Professor Gluck, because she touched on more painful issues that I grapple with every day, is the problem is with the salad bowl issue is that Professor Gluck said it's a little bit difficult when everybody is defining themselves as hyphenated, et cetera, but people usually do it when they're feeling left out of the mixing bowl, whatever it was called, the melting pot, like, the African Americans. They were feeling, weren't entitled to a past or to an opinion or something about their own person. And as an Arab American, I often do not agree with the politics of the United States, which doesn't mean that I don't love my country. And it's a very difficult position because, as you all said, as soon as you don't agree with everybody, it's like you are a traitor. But, I mean, there are unfair things going on, and it's really hard to know what to do about it, how much you can stick your neck out without having your apartment investigated behind your back and whatever. So I would have liked to know, what in particular maybe Professor Gluck has to say about this.
Well, I've thought a lot about this recently because I read a lot of European press. I read a lot of non-American press. So I see this all the time from outside, all the time. It's a very painful picture looking at the United States from outside right now. I wish that everybody could do that. You would be horrified, I think, and by how we look. That led me to the comment that I just skipped across a minute ago, which was we have an obligation to break that 95% support rate. We have an obligation to start speaking up because we have all been cowed. And we have all been cowed because I hear this kind of complaint about all sorts of things, not just for reasons of ethnic discrimination and ethnic profiling. I don't really believe that the U.S. I say this without, but my I did study lots of polls and I saw that 95% support what the Bush administration is doing, but 95% think they should do it multilaterally, and 84% think they shouldn't do it military means. And before you know it, you realize that this is not a consensus that can't be broken apart, because they couldn't. It adds up to 600%. So I am now thinking more and more that it's up to all of us, hyphenated, unhyphenated, to start speaking up about lots of things. Because the only thing that this country, that our administrations listen to, are the polls. And if you are unhappy right now with what's going on, all you have to do is threaten this particular president with what happened to his daddy. And, win the war and lost the election. And I've really sort of changed a little bit on what, and that's why I said common ground and democracy before. We need to all get our complaints, which are very various. Some people don't like the war in Afghanistan. Some people don't like the military trials. Some people don't like the USA Patriot Act. That's great. Everybody should say all of that. And when these pollsters could start to hear that, that's actually the way that the United States works, for better or for worse. And that's why I was talking about the common ground. So that's not the answer to your question. But somebody said, how do we get past that? We can't get past it with the preaching. I don't think so. I mean, we can get education helps, and playing with Albert's children is very important, and I agree with that, and I'll come live with them myself. But in fact, I think we have right now to break what's the immediate problem? We have to break the fact that you got Senate support almost to 100% for something that's called the USA Patriot Act because it was called the USA Patriot Act and because it's times of crisis. Enough.
Okay, I think there are many more questions, and I think we can follow up with questions after the formal panel this evening. I've been given the flag that we're at 8 o'clock and we have to close up. Since Dr. Gluck has finished off on mentioning polls, and if you'll forgive me, another UN reference here. I think in the discussion this evening, which started off on a discussion about racial tolerance, what strikes me is that racial almost doesn't enter into the equation in the sense that the touchstone here seems to me to be the fundamental rights that everyone holds dear regardless of race, and that the tolerance of one another has to be based on those fundamental principles. It struck me when the Japan Society invited me to be part of the program this evening, I was immediately what came to mind was a 1999 Gallup poll, since you mentioned polls. There are different kinds of polls in the world. There was in 1999, the Gallup organization did a poll of something like 57,000 people in 60 countries around the world. And they basically asked people, you know, what mattered to them most in life, and ultimately, there's the UN connection. How did the UN fit into that, and what was the UN's basic function? What was the most important function the UN could perform? And one might start off by thinking that people would think immediately of peacekeeping, of action by the Security Council, maybe development work, maybe other things. The vast majority of the people who responded, and this was a poll that covered a great many countries in all regions. I mean, obviously, 60 countries is not a majority, but the vast majority of the respondents said that the main job, the most important job of the United Nations should be protecting people's human rights. Human rights was the touchstone. And it struck me, looking at that and looking a little bit further at the report from that poll, and they found that the younger the respondent, the more likely the respondent was to cite human rights as being the UN's most important job. And I think, having listened to you all tonight, and I thank the panel very much for the advice that they've come along, and I'm sending my kids down to Albert's house to play with his. I really think that is the touchstone here, that ultimately we can talk about races, we can talk about minorities, we can talk about that sort of identity activism or identity politics, but the touchstone is really individual human rights and fundamental principles that allow us to see one another as human beings. So I'd like to thank you all very much for what I found a very stimulating discussion. Have a good evening.